Hey, this is Jay Bentley, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas, and welcome to episode number 193 of your favorite podcast, Walking the Floor. How you doing? This is Chris Shiflett, as always, your loyal and considerate host. Let me tell you something. The people have spoken. Last week, I posed the question, am I putting out too much content doing this here podcast once a week? Because, you know, we used to be once every 2 weeks. Now I'm doing it once a week, and it's wearing me out. But so I asked the question, and the people have spoken. And when I say the people have spoken, I say at least 5 or 6 people have spoken on my social media to confirm that that's right. We are keeping at once a week for the time being. There was one person that said they couldn't keep up, but there was like another 4 or 5 people who applauded my consistent and disciplined approach to podcasting that I've taken on this year in COVID times. So that's what we're going to do. That's what I'm going to do for now. And we'll see how that goes. We'll see how long I can keep that up. In the meantime, Zounds.com. Did you know that Zounds has 3 warehouses strategically located across the United States to get you your gear faster than anyone else? Did you know that Zounds has been around since 1996? Did you know that Zounds staff is all musicians? I know that because I talk to them all the time about music stuff, music-related things. I don't want to let the cat out of the bag too early here, but I gotta tell you, I'm actually doing a Zounds live stream soon. Beginning of May sometime. More details to follow, but Zounds.com, it is the place to buy your music gear on the interweb. Get over there. And we're going to get on over to today's interview. And if you spent any time in the punk rock world in, you know, the 80s, 90s, whatever, you probably fucking love Bad Religion the way I love Bad Religion. I mean, without Suffer, No Control, Against the Grain, all those records. Like, you just wouldn't have everything that came after it. And I just loved them, and I love Jay Bentley, bass player for Bad Religion, my old pal. I love talking to him. I was excited for this interview. When I listened back, I could tell. I was, like, kind of spazzing out. I was pretty excited. But Bad Religion just wrote a great book. It's, like, their history. It's called Do What You Want, The Story of Bad Religion. They wrote it with Jim Ruland. And we talk about that, and we talk about everything. This is just a really good excuse to catch up with my old buddy, Jay Bentley, bass player extraordinaire, on Walking the Floor.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I can hear you and see you.
Great. Wow, you look like you're in the exact same type of place that I'm sitting in right now.
Your little place that you always weren't, the cave.
The cave. Exactly. That's right. Yeah. We're both in our, welcome to my cave. Yeah.
That's where we spend our time. I'm right here with you.
Nice.
More coffee in the cave.
Oh yeah, you can't go wrong. Hey, do you see the little recording?
I do not. I do. It's on the left hand side. Yep. Good, it's right
good.
There.
Yeah, good.
You're good to go.
I always gotta like really double check that I actually record these things.
I film Natalia's kids art class on Sundays, and I sometimes have forgotten to record, and never. That's a bad thing.
It's a total night. I've done it as a veteran of the podcast community. You'd be shocked at how often I seem to fuck up the recording process of these things.
Well, this isn't what we're supposed to know how to do. We know how to do bar chords. That's it.
Exactly. Hey, you know what I was thinking about getting ready to do this, and thank you for sitting down. You know, I've been wanting to interview you forever. But
No, it's okay. Stop. Ow. Holy cow, that's not cool in my headphones.
I could even hear that through the mic from your headphones.
That was a tough pill.
Hey, there's no way that you're going to remember this, but I was thinking about, I totally remember the first time I kind of met you. This would be a lot less memorable for you, I'm sure, because it was that you guys were playing, I don't know exactly when this was. It was like the early 90s, I want to say. And you guys were playing the country club, beautiful country club in Reseda, California. And I went to that gig with a buddy of mine, and we were at some bar across the street. And I remember, like, you walked into the bar, and
that was my favorite bar.
Oh, no shit. Okay. So you do remember that bar. Yeah. You had on a smoking jacket or something. your hair was kind of shaggy. And I remember, like, you know, I don't think I actually talked to you or anything, but I definitely stood awkwardly near you with a beer.
Okay. They used to have to drag me out of that bar to go play the show. And I would just go, we'd get done playing it. I'd just walk right back over there.
I wish I had known that. I would have walked back over there too. And then gotten up the courage to fanboy out on you.
I wish I remembered the name of that place. I remember going there all the time, but oh well. I loved those shows at the country club, because that really was our backyard.
Right. Literally your backyard for growing
literally,
up. Right.
Yeah. Really, really, truly hometown shows.
Did you go to a lot of shows there when you were a kid?
No. It's strange that the country club when I was a kid was sort of off limits to me.
Right. They weren't having punk rock shows at that point, right?
No, they were, it was Wolf and Rich Miller's country club. They were, right. That's where Van Halen and Squire and Quiet Riot would play there. Even though right. Quiet Riot, I would see at Starwood. The shows that I kind of ended up going to when I was pre-punk 14, were shows that were at movie theaters, that some of my friends would put on.
Right.
Or at school. I saw Sister, which was, shit. Sorry. I'm not trying not to swear.
You can swear. It's a podcast.
Yeah, but I'm trying not to. never mind. I saw a bunch of bands, because out in the valley there was always kind of weird shows happening. But I think the thing about the country club was that was more of a legitimate venue,
right?
That a 14-year-old kid wasn't going to get into,
right? So it had fallen into disrepair when they were letting Bad Religion play.
Oh God,
is that what you're saying?
Yeah, no, by the time we got there, it had gone through its rock and disco phase, and right. We were just sort of the cleanup crew. Everything was, it was a garbage. It was fun to play there, but it wasn't what it used to be.
Right. I went to a lot of shows at the country club, because growing up in Santa Barbara, that was the closest spot, that was like an LA show.
Right.
But we could drive,
right.
Closer than going to the Troubadour or something.
Right. Still, it's a 50-minute drive for you.
Yeah.
60-minute drive.
Yeah. It was not bad. I'm talking about in the early 80s when it was all heavy metal bands and stuff. Like, I would go to all that stuff, but
right. That's the thing that people sort of the punk rock, the early, beginnings of Southern California punk rock were running parallel with that rock explosion of kind of post Van Halen, but Motley Crue.
Right.
You know what I mean? There was this really, healthy burgeoning underground rock world.
Sure.
That was really cool. Oh, I know. Okay. So it was, Blackie Lawless had a band called Sister.
Before Wasp.
Way before Wasp. A friend of mine's older brother, he's like, you got to come see this band. And, they were playing it. I swear to God, they were playing it like some Mexican restaurant. It was like, and I remember he was eating worms, and I'm like, okay, no, it's not for me. It wasn't really my bag at all, but that's the kind of shows that I would go to.
That I did not expect my interview with you to get into Blackie Lawless territory so fast.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I kind of jumped the gun there.
I love it.
Save that one for later. Listen, cool. I always tell people this. I wanted to be a guitar player when I was a kid, by 8, 9, 10. And at my high school at El Camino, I don't know how this happened, but they had a dance in the gymnasium. We actually had it wasn't a gymnasium. It was actually a theater. They had an actual stage, and they got Quiet Riot to come out with Randy Rhoads. And I was there and, stood right in front of him, watched him play. And it sort of ended my guitar dream. Seriously. I'll never be as good as this guy ever.
Right.
But at the same time, I became a huge fan, and I went and saw Quiet Riot with Randy Rhoads play probably half a dozen times.
Because they were from the Valley, right? Wasn't his mom's music store in like North Hollywood or something?
Yeah, they were Valley guys, but it just wasn't unheard of. Just, you know, like Rick Derringer came and played at our high school, so we had we had some pretty cool shows that you wouldn't think of in the 77-78 world. So it was just a thing.
Who were the big bands, like the, you know, big bands with records out and stuff that were sort of your pre-punk stuff? I think for a lot of people, it was like Alice Cooper and Kiss and Nugent, just sort of whatever is the most like gnarly shit of that time. Who was it for you that was sort of got you primed for when punk rock came along?
Well, my two biggest bands were Elton John and Kiss, because I bought Kiss Alive was the first record I bought with my own money.
Right.
Alive One. I went and bought this Kiss Alive, and I was like, wow, this is what I want to do. Like, I want to, like, that live album was like, I don't know what this feels like, but I want to do this. And then it was sort of like you're catching whiffs of Nevermind the Bollocks and the Jam. But at the same time, you're getting Elvis Costello. I didn't have any of these records, but I was hearing these songs.
So the British stuff.
Yeah, it was the British stuff. I didn't know anything about local, like punk rock, local punk rock bands didn't exist to me.
Right.
I didn't know anything about them. I actually, well, I shouldn't say that. I owned the Dickies White EP, but I didn't know the Dickies were from LA. If that makes sense. And when I found out they were from LA, I was kind of like stoked. I was like, wow, these are my local band.
Right, right.
I went and saw The Clash in 79 at the Palladium on the Take the Fifth tour. And that was sort of the opening and closing of both doors. Like I said, I'm all in on this. I'm putting my Kiss records in the trash.
Right.
And that
you're
was
in
done.
A room with like thousands of other people that are like punk rock people. Like, was that like the first time you were at like a big show like that? Like, whoa, there are all these people in this town that I live in that are.
Yeah. And seeing guys jump off the stage and just the whole energy of this thing. I was at the front. There was no barricade. So I was at the front of the stage, and then I wasn't at the front of the stage. And, you know, it was like this swirling pit. Guys would fall down and you'd step on them and try to pick them up. And I was 14, 15, scared, but thrilled.
Right.
And so that was sort of where I cut my hair. I just didn't care anymore. And I'm going to find out what this is all about. And in a strange way, soon after that was when, going back to school, I really started hanging out with Greg Graffin. And then met some other friends through him. And that was when we started venturing into Hollywood to go see Black Flag and the Circle Jerks and Fear. And then you start learning like, okay, these are my bands. These are my local heroes.
And so is that already sort of like I wasn't around for any of this stuff, and the dates and the times get a little vague for me, but like, is the first wave is a little bit more older and artier? It's like bands like X and stuff like that.
And the Screamers that would be the first wave.
Did you get to experience, were you going to any of those shows when you were first getting into it? Did you get to see any of that stuff?
I saw the Screamers once. I saw the Germs once. Some of those older guys were already gone by the time we got there. That second wave of Black Flag and Fear and the Circle Jerks was sort of, they were the, X was always around, but
right.
like the Black Flag, Circle Jerks, Fear was like, that was the three big bands of that second wave. Those were my idols.
And so the mythology goes, in comes the violence, right? Isn't that like sort of like the old guard are like, yeah, these kids from the suburbs came in and ruined it for everybody.
So I'm
curious where you guys fit into that whole lineage, because like there's the bands that you're just talking about is sort of that South Bay thing. I mean, not Fear, but Circle Jerks and Red Cross and Black Flag, there's that South Bay thing. And then was that even a little before the sort of TSOL adolescent?
Totally. Yeah, we were third wave. So third wave was Adolescent Social Distortion, TSOL, us.
Right.
you know, that was, in a weird way, that was like the kids. Because even to us, like Black Flag, those guys were grown-ups.
right, to us.
You know, we were just like little shitty kids.
Yeah.
So that third wave seemed, you know, it seemed to be comprised of a much younger generation of players who didn't have any idea what they were doing.
And you guys were like geographically separate from all that, right? I mean, I think of all that as being like way down in Orange County or whatever. Was there camaraderie between all the, you know, third wave bands and bands in the scene at that point?
Yeah,
or
I think
competition,
so.
Or
well, both. We were definitely isolated in Woodland Hills in Canoga Park. Like, there was nobody out there really.
Right.
And some of the bands we became more friendly with than others. Like the two bands that really seemed to that we sort of rode in the van with were the Circle Jerks and the Adolescents. Those two bands were really important in not only in us becoming who we were, but they gave us an opportunity to, they always put us on the bills with that they got. If they were playing a show, they'd say, "Oh, we want Bad Religion to play." It's like, okay, right. So we just did. And so there was a camaraderie, but then there was also other bands that you were more competitive with, you know, for no real reason. It just seemed like you weren't really friendly. You weren't unfriendly. You just did your thing.
Yeah.
I mean, and then there was a bunch of bands he just didn't care about.
there's that story in the book, and I want to talk a little bit more in depth on the book in a moment. But there's that story in the book where you're talking about, and I forget exactly. I think Bad Religion was up and running at this point, where somebody gets like beaten to death at Okie Dog, and somehow your name gets wrapped up in it, and maybe Mike Muir from Suicidal was somehow involved in that. The cops come. Could you talk
that
about
was,
story that
was that was that was. I'm that might be pre-suicidal. It was more of a Dogtown issue than a Suicidal issue.
Okay.
And it had more to do with Jay Adams and Dennis Agnew and myself and a couple of other people. We were just at Okie Dogs and a fight broke out, and as was kind of normal. And the only reason that my name got brought into this wasn't really my name. It was just that as people were going like, "Let's get out of here. This is crazy." You know, as I was driving away, someone just said, "Hey, I saw you. And I'm like, "I don't know what you saw me do, but you saw me." And they took my license plate. And that was sort of the beginning of me getting pulled into this by the cops, but had less to do with me doing anything and more to do with someone just writing down my plate.
For people listening that don't know the glorious history of Okie Dog, that was like punk rock hangout spot, right? Pat Smear told me that across the street from Okie Dog was some other fast food joint that was where like the heavy metalers would go to.
It was Astro Burger.
Okay, so that and that was the source of many conflicts, was, you know,
somebody would
wander into the wrong parking lot or something.
The funny part was there was a lot of fights in the crosswalk between the two. And one of the thing was like Okie Dog, the food at Okie Dog was kind of not that great. And so a lot of us would walk across the street to get French fries and onion rings at Astro Burger because it was better food.
Right.
You know, yeah.
The shit would kick off.
Kinda, sometimes. Not usually. It's funny. Like the people that fought were usually looking for a fight.
Right.
And, you know, they just kind of wanted to go fight. And then there was people that just wanted onion rings. Right. I'm not really looking for a fight. Yeah. I just want some onion.
Yeah, I'm not gonna die on the onion ring hill.
No, nah, it's
not
worth
the
it.
Hill I'm dying on.
No,
I mean, I remember being a kid in Santa Barbara and hearing all these tales of like punk rock gangs and, you know, the Lads and FFF and Suicidal and Mickey Mouse Club and all that crazy shit. Like it, and like I said, I wasn't around for anything, but it sounded like it was fucking violent, man, by that time. Like, was every gig like result in being beaten to death by the riot police, or like what was that like?
You know, from my perspective, it was worse in the late 80s. Like by the time we started playing Fender's Ballroom, it was much worse than it was in the early 80s.
Oh really?
Yeah. And Lads was a kids. It was Mad Society Kids.
Right, right.
It wasn't. It was never meant to be anything other than like, look, this guy's 8 years old. So let's have a bunch of 15-year-olds get together and have armbands so that we're protecting each other, because 10 15-year-olds equals one 26-year-old.
Right.
And that was the thought process behind that. Obviously, everything got bigger and dumber. And then, even though you want to think like, oh, all of these gangs were happening, but by 83, 84, the scene had kind of dried up.
Right.
So what were you really going to accomplish anyways? That's why I'm saying, like, by the time 87, 88, we were playing Fender's Ballroom, those were times where we'd be playing and fights would break out and we'd just stop playing, going like, we're not doing this. We're not the background noise for this.
Right. When you said the scene had kind of dried up by 83, 84, like what had it evolved into?
From my perspective, the clubs had just said, look, every time we put on one of your guys' shows, our toilets get torn out and someone tries to light the place on fire. So you're not invited back.
Right.
And the only thing that made sense was, well, hold on. If you just put a guitar solo in the middle of those two verses and call yourself speed metal, you can get a show. Right. All right. So it switched between who could play where, and, you know, bands that had a reputation, whether it was Bad Religion, Wasted Youth, TSOL, whatever, you just weren't going to get shows.
What you just touched on is something really I think really musically important, how punk rock, a lot of it had morphed into that crossover space between thrash metal and punk rock. Like, a lot of those bands were sort of like feeding off each other by the mid 80s, late 80s. And
yeah.
To me, that's like what made Suffer, and I'm kind of jumping around a little bit here, but that's like what made Suffer such a shot in the arm. It was such like a breath of fresh air when that record came out. Cause I gotta be honest, I was not a fan of a lot of the crossover thing. That shit never appealed to me. Like, by that time I had gotten turned on to punk rock, but I was listening to punk rock from like the 70s and the early 80s. And then when Suffer came out, it was like the first time it was like, oh shit, this is current, and it gets me. You know,
maybe the only reason that it was current was because we made it in a bubble. We didn't really have anything to compare ourselves to, because we didn't even know who was out there.
Right.
You know, the shows that we were playing, we were playing a 6-year-old album. How could hell be any worse? And even most of the bands that we were playing with were not from LA. Like, we'd be on a bill with Murphy's Law or Scream, you know, and you'd be like, okay. And you weren't really sure what was happening, and none of it really mattered. You were just going to play your songs and go home.
Right.
And when Brett came back into the band and Greg and Brett started writing the songs for Suffer, it was really fast. Like, they wrote this album in weeks. We recorded it and mixed it in 4 days.
No shit.
It was just done. We just did it in a bubble, not thinking anything about what it meant. We knew that we liked it, like, wow, this is really good, but it didn't mean anything to anybody else.
Right. Once it came out, though, I mean, were you sort of aware in real time the impact that it was having?
No.
I mean, you could argue that that record spawned like kind of almost everything in our world of punk rock that came after it. I mean, I don't think there would have been a NOFX or a Pennywise or a Lagwagon or a No Use for Name. At least none of those bands would have sounded the way they sounded if it wasn't for that album.
Maybe, but I mean, in real time, we put the record out and it just kind of, you know, people didn't really care that much. And then by the end of the year, Flipside and Maximum Role had it on the cover of their magazines as album of the year. And maybe that sort of started this ball rolling of people saying, oh, I wonder what that's about. And so it's funny, more people kind of kept coming in saying, this is a perfect record. But there was this little backhanded compliment of like, nothing will ever be better than this.
Really? Already from when it came out. No,
right, from when it came out. And it was kind of like, well, but okay. And then we started writing No Control, going like, well, no, we're going to do better than this.
Right. Here, have or, I Want to Conquer the World.
Right. Yes. Something different. So, you know, it seems like Suffer was the record that changed everything, but in real time, it didn't really change much until we got a few years away from it and people started looking back at where did this come from?
Right.
And you could sort of point at this thing that happened in 1988. And then it started to gain the reputation of like, oh, this was the beginning of something.
Right. Hey, let's talk specifically about the book and how it came about. I loved reading your book. I thought it was so much fun because it made me realize that I don't know shit about your band. I didn't know shit about your band.
You're not supposed to. You're really not supposed to.
And I thought I was like a mega fan, man. And I was like, because you guys are, you know, the stuff from early on, you know, there was no fucking internet and nobody really knew anything besides what was on a band's album cover. And it's not like,
right.
You know, was in a room with any of you folks or right. But, you know what I mean? So it's like, so that part of it, I just love, but I was curious because I remember when we made the Foo Fighter documentary a few years ago, we all sat down and did interviews for it, but you're doing interviews separately. So you're kind of like, how honest is everybody going to
right.
be with telling the story? Did you go through that when you guys were, I don't know how you got the book together, but I assume you did a bunch of interviews. Like, were you like, how honest are my bandmates going to be about this stuff?
We had a handshake agreement that we weren't going to talk shit on each other. Like that was just right. Like, let's not make this a dirt book.
Right. We're not going to litigate our
right. issues. Right. In 40 years of being in a band, you have plenty of stories, good and bad.
Yeah.
You know, you can go either way with it. And it was like, look, let's just not unload all the dirty laundry or whatever, because there really isn't that much, but why even bother with it? So we did kind of say like, look, let's reinforce the good part of the band.
Right.
And knowing myself and knowing Brian, one of the things that he and I have both sort of embraced over the years is be as honest as you can about things, because that's what makes interviews great. When people say, I can't believe you just said that, it's like, why wouldn't I say that? That's how I honestly feel. As long as it's not like talking about someone else and you can say, well, this is what I did.
Right.
Or this is something that happened.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's part of it, knowing how honest everyone is going to be, is sort of like, that's their cross to bear, you know? And I've even said, look, the Bad Religion book is a collective of 8 or 9 guys, depending on how you look at it. And my story is that would be for my book. If I'm going to write a book, then that's my story. This is our story.
Right.
And I think that's how everybody sort of approached it, was like, this isn't about me. This is about us and how right. we did this.
And did the book jar some memories loose for you? Like just having to sit down and go through all that stuff. I know it's anytime I'm like talking about the good old days with my friends, like their version of the good old days is so radically different from my old senile brain that it right. always like kind of jars a few things loose.
Sometimes I think the thing is, like, people were asking about like, well, how did, you know, what stories are the ones that made it into the book? And I said, the stories that Jim talked about. There's other stories that like, you know, as the writer, it was Jim's job basically to just hear a tidbit of information from Pete Finestone and then come to me and say, Pete said this,
right.
What do you think? And then I would tell him a story about that. And then he would go talk to Greg about it. And Greg would say something different. And he'd come back to me, well, Greg said this. And I go, yeah, but also part of this. And then,
right.
you know,
right.
So, you know, he had his work cut out for him to try to put all that together and make it make sense, which I think he did a great job.
Right. Is your ceiling falling in right now?
No, I was like, I was looking up at the light because I'm like, that's a bright light. and then I just stared right into it because, you know, that's what you have to do.
That's what you do. Staring into the sun. Hey, a buddy of mine who was like one of my, you know, we listened, like one of my main Bad Religion friends when growing up, I asked him last night if he had any burning desire questions that I should ask you. And I will forget to ask this unless I just do it. So where exactly did you shoot the cover for How Could Hell Be Any Worse? Where is that? What is that vantage point?
So if you're driving up the 405, just leaving West LA. So you're driving through, you know, and there used to be that big, wait, not the 405, the 101. If you're driving up the 101 and you're just passing the Capitol Records Tower,
right?
on the right-hand side, there used to be this big illuminated cross.
Right. Yeah, I remember that.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Okay. Totally. So we hiked up to that with Ed Culver, and we were up there shooting at that big cross, and he turned around and just, you know, shot this kind of eerie. It was a cloudy, weird day.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just shot the you know, he shot the landscape. He shot that scenery, and then we just did it red and said, "That's cool."
Cross gone now? Is that gone?
I think so. I haven't really looked, but I think it's gone. If it's not, that's where we did.
That's where we did. That's so funny. That cross, I have such a strange memory. That cross is like burned into my brain because my grandma used to live right there.
Right.
Right down there in Hollywood. And we used to drive right by that cross
right.
every time we would go visit.
I don't see. It's been so long that I'm putting it on the 405 and I'm like, no, that's not right.
It's right. Yeah. It's funny because I actually tried to include that image in a song I wrote a few years ago, and I had remembered it being in that stretch of Ventura between Santa Barbara and Ventura where there's like all those oil rigs, but I just did some weird like combo memory. But yeah,
right. Right. But that's where we walked up to that and took a bunch of pictures around that thing, and that's where that cover shot came from.
You know, I had no idea that Brett had left the band before Suffer.
Until we kind of all left the band other than Greg. Right.
Well, it sounded like it didn't exactly break up, or maybe it did for a minute, but then you guys, there was a time there where Brett was not playing with you guys. Right.
Right.
I mean, I think maybe you weren't playing with them.
I wasn't playing. After Into the Unknown, I left during the recording of Into the Unknown. They sent Pete away in the recording of Into the Unknown. And then after the record came out, Brett left. So there wasn't much left of the band. I remember there was a time where Brett and I went to go see Bad Religion at the, where the hell did we go? The Café de Grand. And I don't know who was in the band. And obviously Graffin was in the band.
Hetson was in the band, right?
Hetson was there. Yeah. But, you know, it might have been John Albert playing drums, and I have no idea who was playing bass. But
that's how I feel when I look at a promo shot of me first in the Gimme Gimmes now.
Right.
Exactly the same way. Who the fuck is that?
Who are these people? I know.
Did that make it easier when Brett left in the 90s to deal with? Like, oh, we've been here before.
No, honestly, the thing about, you know, and this is my estimation, what makes Bad Religion work as well as it does is the yin and yang of Greg and Brett.
Right.
You know, Greg is this no nonsense professor where it's like, this is science. And Brett is this hopeless romantic who is just always wanting things to be as beautiful as you could imagine a religion telling you that it is, but just can't get there because, you know, I just can't jump off the cliff.
Right.
And so Brett struggles with that. And between the two of them, when they write songs, it's almost as if they're playing against each other, like a tennis match. And that's right. What makes it work. And when Brett left, it was like, that's going to be a big hole to fill.
Right.
And it wasn't like we couldn't find another songwriter. We just found another guitar player who was like, okay, this person will musically fill this giant void. And he's got a pretty good backstory. But it was challenging.
Yeah. It's interesting because it sounds like they don't write so much together.
Not at
there's
all.
There's something about the when it's both of their songs, and I assume whatever, you know, Brett's role in the studio, because he's still involved now with making the records.
Yep.
Like, there's something there. That's, I mean, that's one of those like magic qualities of music that there's just, you just see that. It's like Mick Jones and Joe Strummer or something. Like they just kind of need whatever it is that other guy's doing to balance it. You know?
Right. They really come in with their material pretty complete, and you know, maybe Brett will say, maybe say this word instead of that word, and Greg will maybe help his melody line a little bit. You know, they do complement each other, but they really, the nuts of their material is coming from them, not really together.
Right. You mentioned Into the Unknown, and I just looked before we did this interview, and it's still not in the streaming services. I mean, after all this time, anybody that wants to find it can just find it on YouTube. Why is that record not in the streaming services?
I don't know. How is that my fault?
It's not your fault, but you have a vote. Or wait, you didn't play on it, so I guess maybe you don't have a vote.
I don't have a vote.
It deserves to be there.
I remember we were talking about when Brett said, like, oh, I'm going to do this, vinyl collection. And we definitely brought up Into the Unknown and said, like, that should absolutely be in there. Like, so that was a part where we said, like, no complete discography would be complete without it. So,
right. So it's in that vinyl re-release,
Yeah. And none of us are trying to hide it or sweep it under the rug. It's just like, why invest any time or money into it? Like, sure. To put it on streaming services, I don't know what that would take. I know that the only official versions that we have or own are all analog.
Right.
So, I mean, even for someone like Brett, it's like, why would I want to go digitize this? Even $50 is probably too much to spend on Into the Unknown.
Right. Well, I don't know.
I don't either. I don't know either. And that's like, okay, fine.
Yeah. I realize my vote doesn't count, but my vote is put it in the goddamn streaming services.
Fine. I'll bring it up at the next meeting.
I'll tweet at Brett on the Twitter machine. Was it Europe when things really, like, where things really first started to take off?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why do you think the scene over there was so strong at that point in the mid 80s
I think they were looking for something different. Who knows why things happen. I know that in Germany in particular, there just seemed to be this fondness for US punk rock.
Right.
And especially a band like us with our vocabulary, it's like, if English is your second language, the hoops that you would have to jump through to even begin to understand the things that we were talking about was
English
monumental.
English was my first language, and I couldn't understand half of it.
But I could
tell that you were pissed.
Yeah. Well, Joey still has one of my favorite quotes of all time. We were playing some festival and some guy was on stage yelling something, and Joey goes, I don't know what that guy's so mad about, but it can't be important. And like I said, you've really figured this all out.
Yeah. That's pretty much, that's, you could just apply that to our whole country right now.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
But so, that sort of, and I'm going to use this word, that appreciation of what we were doing was what drove us to do more of that.
Right.
And, you know, that was like, they like this, let's do more.
Right. Well, I mean, and you guys did a lot in a very short period of time. It seemed like every year there was a new Bad Religion record for a while there.
Yeah. I think for the better part of 5 or 6 years, we put out a record a year.
Right. I mean, what did you make of the sort of when it became a little bit later on, like in the 90s, when that scene became mainstream and like, and I'm not just talking about like the Offspring, Green Day and that sort of level of things, but there was like a moment there, you know, where everything became Giant Shorts and Arnett's and G-Shocks, and it sort of became like a almost like a homogenized mainstream version of what you guys had been doing.
I thought that was like that imagery seemed to be more of the extension of the Warped Tour as we knew it,
right,
than really of us, you know. Because
sure. That's kind of what I'm getting at, is like, you guys to me always seemed a bit separate from that, but we're like at its fucking core, you know.
Well, I think that if you look at like just prior to that explosion, the two biggest alternative bands, and I mean like underground, I'm not talking like the Pixies or that kind, I'm talking about like Fugazi and Bad Religion, Discord and Epitaph were like the biggest underground issue.
Yeah.
And even though at the time Nirvana was on Geffen, when that record came out and really blew up, everything changed. Right.
And right.
But you didn't see people like saying like, well, Nirvana ruined everything. It's like, no, they didn't at all. And nobody was saying the Offspring ruined everything. It just, the audience for that was, they sort of homogenized themselves into this look, into this right. fashion. And you're like, right. I don't know where you're getting this idea that this is what we all look like, but okay. and you know, you sort of just accepted it with the grain of salt. It wasn't until we started seeing more bands dressing like that audience where you're like, well, now you're dressing like people who are trying to dress like they've been to the Warped Tour. I don't get this at all.
And I, by the way, I didn't mean it from the sense of it being ruined or the scene.
No. I know, but
I just mean that, you know, you like your band spans this timeline of like, you know, from like the early 80s when the scene was very different, when like being a punk rock band was not a lucrative career choice for anybody, through like the desert years of all that and into this, and then all of a sudden it just fucking explodes and goes crazy.
Right. And you know, Greg was the first person to say, and rightfully so, because it was a valid form of music. It didn't deserve to be sort of swept under the rug and said like, well, you guys are underground alternative to what?
Right.
You know, so I flippantly said I would band talk about important issues, whatever those, talking about getting high and being lonely on the road. It's like, yeah, give me something more to chew on. It certainly wasn't a good time, but it did change a lot for everybody. Hey, it says my internet connection is unstable. I'm stoked.
Oh, I hear you.
I'm unstable.
It got a little shaky there for a minute, but I think it seems to have corrected. You know, it's funny. I didn't really realize until I had kids many years after all of that, just how deeply that sound had like kind of permeated popular culture until I just remember watching like modern Scooby-Doo movies that would have like pop punk soundtracks and stuff. And this was like right. way after all that stuff. But like I'm always kind of fascinated by that. Like in the years in the music industry, since I meet so many people that are in bands that don't sound anything like Bad Religion or NOFX or whatever, they're like, dude, I grew up going to fucking Lagwagon shows or what, you know, like that right. whole thing. It's just in the ether, you know?
Yeah. You know, there's good and bad to all of that. It's sort of right. on one hand, it's good for that sort of music to be permeating into society, because I think it's important. On the other hand, it waters it down by people saying that they want to be in that kind of a band, but not understanding the intent of that band. And now you've got like, well, it's just a job. It's like, no, it's not a job. It's sort of an ethos. It's a life lesson in all of this. It is to me.
Like in terms, like, what do you mean for ethos wise?
Well, you know, it's like people would say, well, you're punk if you have short hair. It's like, it doesn't matter what your hair is like. It takes you right. a while to get out of that.
Right, 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 right.
Where you start to realize it's just how you wake up in the morning.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would always laughingly say, if anyone wants to define what punk is, then it is my job to make sure that I defy that definition. Right. Short hair is punk. I'm growing my hair out. Ripped jeans are punk. I'm wearing a suit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
Because all of those things are just physical manifestations of an idea.
Right.
But it is the idea that's important.
Right.
It's not the presentation.
Sure. And I feel like it's almost impossible to define, you know, it's
been and so rightfully
many different
so.
Things to different people. You know?
And rightfully so. It is, you know, the minute that you try to define it, then that's the maximum rock and roll effort of like, well, we're going to basically start pigeonholing all of the bands and people. It's like, no, that's counterproductive.
Right.
You know, you end up just turning everybody against each other.
It's funny reading through the book. One of the things, your guys' scheduling made me feel exhausted as a longtime band member. Just thinking about Greg, you know, going to school for a million years and then becoming a professor and all that stuff. And the band sort of working around that and then working around Brett's schedule as Epitaph grew. And then everybody else is just life and people coming in. And I was like, oh my God, this makes me, it's giving me anxiety just reading about it as a musician.
Right. But you know, we're super fortunate to be able to do this for a living.
Yeah.
You know, and I think Brian and I have always just said, look, we took this part from Glenn Gary, Glenn Ross. We would just say, we're just men trying to make a living.
Right.
And that work, was a better job than any job I had ever had before. I was driving a forklift at Epitaph.
Right.
When I had to leave Epitaph, Brett had to leave the band, Greg left school, and we said, let's put the pedal to the metal and go out on the road for 8 or 9 months a year.
Right.
See how that is.
Yeah.
And it turned out like, okay, this is what we're doing. And so just kept doing it.
Obviously right now is bananas because nobody can tour, but how do you, under normal circumstances, how does the modern day Bad Religion approach that?
4 weeks tops, but we'll always stretch it to 5, 3 weeks off.
Right.
You know, before this, there was a 5-year plan of just kind of easing up to, instead of playing 160 shows a year, maybe playing 60 to 100 shows a year, trying to ease up a schedule, but that's now out the window.
Sure.
So who knows?
What are you guys doing now? Are you doing live streams and whatnot?
We did this decades series. We shot 4 shows at the Roxy. So the first show was 1980s. The second show was 1990s. The third show was 2000s. The fourth show was 2010s.
No way.
2020. Yeah. So
right.
So you know it works for us because we've got a lot of material.
Yeah.
You know, we've 17 studio albums and EPs and, you know, close to 400 songs. So I was on the phone with Greg the other day and we really had a good time making these shows, but we really just scratched the surface of our catalog and said, well, we can do it again and play completely different shows for each decade again.
Right.
So maybe we'll do that. And we talked about, like you were talking about, Into the Unknown. Well, what if we just went out and played that album in its entirety with you know, fog machines and mustaches?
I'll be front row on my computer watching the live stream. Right.
Let's give that album some credit and just make it a thing. Because that's all we can do right now is you switch from being a stage performer to being more of a television variety artist.
Yeah.
And not all of us are super comfortable doing that. We're trying.
Yeah. Well, this whole time has forced everybody to sort of like rethink how we all do stuff. And says something tells me that it's never, touring will come back online at some point. Things will get more or less back to normal, but I don't think it's ever going to go back to, I think that a lot of this stuff is going to be with us.
I do too. My thought is, like, think about somebody shaking up a snow globe, and when it all settles down, when we were out on the road, we sort of knew the hierarchy of bands and where they belonged on the totem pole. You'd say like, well, you know, they're up there, or we're in the middle, or these guys are like they're getting their legs. This is the thing that concerns me is like some of the bands that were just on the cusp of making that next step on the rung of the next ladder, where are they going to come back to?
Right.
And us, like, where are we going to come back to? We were high middle, and had some status, but do we come back and go, oh yeah, we don't like those guys anymore. Where do you fit in when this comes back? So there will be some work cut out for all of us when we can go play live, to like, all right, who are we? Where are we?
Right. Yeah. And I think it's going to, even when touring comes back, I think it's not like they're just going to flick a switch and it's going to be like people jumping all over each other. It's going to be like socially distanced and reduced capacity. It'd be weird. But I think, we've done a little bit of live streaming too. And even that, when there's like basically no crowd other than a crew, you know, even that's been pretty fun. So I had
a great time doing it. I think that, you know, we learned 80 songs.
Wow.
And by the end of that, I forgot where I lived. I was like, I burned way too many brain cells trying to figure out all these songs. And I
did you do the shows back to back?
Yeah.
Oh shit. Yeah. So you didn't have like a week to get 20 down.
No,
you just do them all.
No, we, you know, Brian said, I think 4 days of rehearsal is enough. And we spent 2 days kind of farting around going like, the light on the app works. Let's go get a burrito. That kind of,
rehearsals. That's band rehearsal, right?
Yeah. We didn't do that very well. And so, I'd like to get another shot at that, but I had a great time just sort of playing with guys again. That was really fun.
Yeah. Well, that's great, man. I love you guys and can't wait to see you live again.
Well, you know how long we've loved you. Remember Brian and I would sit side stage and watch you play on the Warped Tour day after day after day. Brian's like, this is the guy.
Oh, I'm for reals, dude. Like that was like, whatever that was, 98 Europe Warped Tour or something. Yeah. I have so many great memories from those shows for sure. I'm actually, you know what? I'm going on Kevin Lyman is doing some sort of Warped Tour podcast thing. I'm going to go.
Oh, that's great.
This weekend, like me and Jennifer from L7 and O, I think, and Kevin. Yeah. So
that's great.
Yeah. Looking forward to it.
I mean, I use the Warped Tour as really, you know, it's my litmus test for where I put someone in my mind when I talk to them about the business of that we're in.
Right.
And I'm like, if you've ever been out on a Warped Tour, you understand things a little sideways.
Right.
And more to my liking. And I find that people that like, oh, I never did one. It's like, yeah, we're not going to get along very well.
If you haven't lived the survival skills necessary to find like where the catering is in the morning or whatever to get coffee and promoter pasta and all that shit. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You have 80 bands playing and everyone's just trying to help each other make this happen on a Tuesday in Idaho.
Right.
And, you know, so that you can get to Kansas City.
Yeah.
Cause it's like, all right, whatever it takes.
Oh yeah. I mean, the second No Use for a Name tour I ever did in 95, right after I joined the band, was the first year of the Warped Tour, and whatever the Warped Tour eventually became, it was not that first year.
No,
but there were some like incredible, like, you know, come on guys, we're all going to get over this mountain kind of moments where like,
right,
the gig was, I remember somewhere in Texas, like the thing, it just got canceled and they basically just set it up in the parking lot, but it wasn't like the parking lot of the Enormo Dome. It was like just some parking lot downtown.
Right.
You
right. Know? Some shopping mart. Like, right. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. We, you know, when it was starting up, we said like, well, let's let it run a couple of times without us. Let's see how that goes.
Yeah.
That's what, you know, we came in 98 and said like, it seems like they figured it out now. Let's go out.
Oh no, I remember that the next year, and don't get me wrong, I had an insane amount of fun on that 95 Warped Tour, but the 96 Warped Tour, like 95 Warped Tour was great. And it was like us and like Seaweed was out there and L7 was like headlining Quicksand and Sick of It All was on, you know, I met all these people from, you know, all over the place. But the next year was like Pennywise, NoFX, Lag. It was like the whole scene was on it, and except for us, we were like, oh,
right,
fuck.
right. and that's kind of how we felt, like, oh, we missed out on that. And it's funny, that's part of that was we actually switched our agent with all of that. We went with Daryl because we said, well, we missed out on this, and then we just felt that wasn't something we should have missed out on.
Right.
By that 96, 97 thing, we're like, well, it's up and running and it's valid, but we're not getting any love here. That wasn't really their fault. It was our fault. So when we switched over and it was like, now we're just part of all of this.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember, but that 98 European Warped Tour, we were a last minute substitute. So we weren't actually even advertised as being on it because, who was it? No Fun At All had dropped off at the last second, and Lyman was like, hey, do you guys want to go? So we were just like, yeah, okay, cool. But it was, yeah, it was a trip, because it was like doing a, I mean, we did a whole European tour that like nobody knew we were there until we started on stage
right.
that day.
Right.
Like,
right.
wait a minute, I know that song. That's, you know, that kind of
thing. Right. And, yeah. and then Pollock built a whole career around that one, that one Euro Warp tour. It's like, yeah. all right, cool. Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, fuck, dude, I'll let you get to it. Thank you for doing this today. I love talking to you, bud.
Yeah, I mean, we've got hours to talk.
Yeah. And we got to get in the water.
We do that.
Did you see your children cry when you left them at the station? Hey, moral soldier, you've got
to... Oh, yeah, that was Jay Bentley from Bad Religion on Walking the Floor. Make sure you go out and pick up a copy of Do What You Want, The Story of Bad Religion. It's awesome. I learned a heck of a lot about a band that I thought I knew a lot about and figured I really didn't know shit. So go out there, get that book. And next week we're going to be back with Corb Lund, because I tell you what, the people have spoken and the people want some Corb Lund. So, oh, Canada, it's coming. It's coming, Canada. Get ready. All right, that's it for this week. Adios, amigos.